Welcome back. We have now essentially completed the study of the differential geometric methods that we need, and we now launch into general relativity. The plan is threefold. We will study the dynamics of matter and radiation first. That's what we will do today. So that will be the Dirac equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, Maxwell equations. And then next in this course, we will do the energy momentum tensor and its properties. And then we can go into the dynamics of space-time, general relativity fully. And then we will apply that to cosmology and so on, and black holes. So first of all, let us remember that if we are to describe matter and radiation fields on a space-time, then they will have to obey equations of motion that are chart independent, because the choice of chart is a human choice, and that's not what nature can care about. So what we are looking for is equations that are covariant, that are not dependent on what coordinate system we choose. We will study the, in principle, equations of motions of any kind of field, any kind of tensor field. So let's call this tensor field psi. And for each species of particle, there will be different fields. And we will apply the general notation of the psi coefficient functions having upper indices that stand for contravariant degrees of freedom, lower indices that stand for the covariant degrees of freedom as always, and then perhaps also another subscript within brackets which labels the species. You know, one could be a Klein-Gordon field of, I don't know, the inflaton, and another one could be a Higgs field, and yet another one could be electromagnetism, and so on. What we will not do is study the fermionic nature, the anti-symmetric, the anti-commuting properties of fermions. We will study them in first quantization, where that doesn't matter yet, except if you have multiple of them. And we start with an elementary question, namely, sure, we can put all sorts of tensor fields on a manifold, and these tensor fields can describe all sorts of species of particles. But could we also have additional connection fields? After all, we have one connection that describes the shape of the manifold. What if there are other connections too? Then do we have multiple manifolds and multiple curvatures or so? And it turns out, no, the situation is actually simpler than that. Namely, it turns out that if we have multiple connection fields, multiple connection one forms, let's say gamma and gamma tilde, then the difference between the two is just a regular tensor field. So we can view this as having one connection one form and having another tensor. So that means that the claim here is, and we will prove it in a moment, is that instead of saying we have two connections, we could say we have one connection plus a tensor field. So that arbitrariness is absorbed by just saying we just look at all sorts of tensor species. So why is it that the difference between two connections is a tensor field? Well, let's look at it from the physicist's perspective of what a tensor field is. Namely, we can recognize tensor fields from the physicist's perspective by their transformation properties. And in this case, this is the easiest way to see that the difference between two connections is a tensor field. So let's consider the connection gamma. Under a change of chart, it will transform in this way. Remember that if this first term was absent, then that would indicate, oh, the Christoffel symbols transform like a tensor, because that's how the transformation properties should be for a tensor. But in addition, we get these terms. These terms are present even if there was no Christoffel symbol to start with. We can create a non-zero Christoffel symbol just by changing chart. This is, for example, describing pseudo-forces on a carousel. So we might live in Minkowski space, but if we choose funny coordinates, then we can generate that term, which leads to contributions through the gamma, so the newly generated gamma contribution that lead to pseudo-forces that will make geodesics look like they're curved in that coordinate system. Now, if we put another Christoffel symbol also on that manifold, a gamma tilde, then it transforms the same way. And those two terms are identical, which means that the difference between gamma and gamma tilde transforms without that term. So it transforms just like that. That's the transformation property of the difference between two Christoffel symbols, and that's tensorial. So therefore, the difference is always a one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant tensor. That's of interest for two reasons. One is that it tells us that we don't have to worry about different species associated with different connections, because really we can think of just having one connection plus tensor fields. But there's another point, and that's even more important, which is that if we consider a fixed manifold and a fixed Riemannian or Lorentzian manifold with its connection gamma, and then we vary the gamma, for example, for the purpose of a functional differentiation, so we vary it, then that variation is tensorial. So if we take a gamma and we look at the variation of it, the delta of gamma, that's tensorial. Of course, variations are going to be important when we study equations of motion, because the Euler-Lagrange equations are derived by functional differentiation, and we may have to functionally differentiate with respect to those guys eventually. But for now, I mean, this I just want to put there for later reference. For now, we will look at the equations of motion of matter fields and radiation fields. And there we have to do a functional differentiation with respect to the matter fields and with respect to the radiation fields. So here's the action principle as we know it from special relativity. Namely, that any theory of matter fields and radiation fields, actually from now on, let's just speak of matter fields. In astrophysics and in cosmology, the terminology is that matter is everything that's not gravity. So even light would be called matter. So they would say, okay, there's curvature, there's gravity, and then there's matter. And that includes radiation. Okay, so with that terminology, any theory of matter fields can be defined by specifying the Lagrangian, which is a function, which is a scalar function of all sorts of tensor fields that go into the description of species. So what we have is that the Lagrangian, which is a scalar function of all sorts of tensor fields, I mean, that can include scalars, vectors, and higher order tensors, and as we will later see, also spinners. And the Lagrangian depends on the fields themselves and also on their derivatives. Since everything needs to be covariant, it's the covariant derivatives that it can depend on. And the Lagrangian can also depend on the metric. For now, we take the metric as a given fixed background metric. Later, we will study what happens when we vary also with respect to g, when we also calculate, therefore, the equations of motion for the metric. So given the Lagrangian, we define the so-called action functional. The action functional is obtained by taking the Lagrangian, which is a scalar, and then taking the volume form, square root of g, d4x, and integrating that over the space-time. Actually, we integrate it over a bounded and closed four-dimensional region of space-time, and let's call that region B. If we were to integrate it over all of space-time, we might end up with an infinity. So we don't do that, but instead we take a chunk of it and we integrate over that. We can always make that chunk much larger than the region we're actually interested in. So what that means is that we have a function now in the sense that we can plug in a bunch of functions, psi, which are these scalar, vector, tensor, spinor valued fields, and obtain a number. A functional is traditionally, a functional is a map of functions into numbers. And that number is called S of psi. So now the action principle, or the action postulate of classical physics, is that in nature, the physical fields psi are such that S of psi is extremal in the space of all fields, which means that the matter fields obey the equation ds by d psi equal to zero. Technically, it actually only means that they are critical. It doesn't mean that they are that the action is maximum or minimum. It could also be a saddle point, right? And of course, if this was a course on quantum field theory, as the course will be next term, in the winter term, we will also see where this is coming from. The action principle of classical theory arises from the path integral of quantum theory by the stationary phase approximation. Right? So when you take the path integral and you look at the stationary phase approximation of the path integral, then you find that this is the equation of motion for the stationary phase approximation. And then the higher order contributions in the stationary phase approximation give us quantum fluctuations that are powers of h bar squared, h bar to the third, which are the loop contributions. This is the tree level contribution from the perspective of quantum field theory. All right, so these equations in classical theory will be the equations of motions for the various fields. So if we functionally differentiate with respect to one species, set that equal to zero, that will be the equation of motion for that species. But how exactly is this defined? How are we to interpret this? What is this delta here, this little delta S, delta psi? How is that mathematically defined? For that, we need to define what we mean by the variation of a field. What is delta psi? So the variation of a field, of one of these species, for example, in a region B, is technically speaking a one-parameter deformation of that field with a parameter one parameter lambda that has a finite range between on a finite interval around zero. So we take the field and we modify it a little bit. If lambda is equal to zero, then we are not supposed to have modified the field, but as we crank up or down the lambda, the field gets modified. This is also here. So here's the picture of it. Imagine this whole thing here is the manifold. And then we carve out a piece of it that we call B. And in that region B, we want to calculate the action. And in that region B now, we define what we mean by a variation of a field. So on B, on the entire manifold, our field is defined, right? The psi index I means the ith species. And then it depends on the point P where we evaluate it, right? So at every point of the manifold, our field takes some tensor value. And that's the value for the parameter lambda equal to zero. If we choose in this family of this one parameter family of fields, if we choose the parameter lambda equal to zero, then it's the original unvaried field, the original field psi of p that we were starting with. So psi I of zero p is psi I of p. P is the choice of point on the manifold. But secondly, we have that lambda is a continuous deformation of psi. So as we crank up lambda, the values of the field psi change, but they change only in the region B. And from the boundary onwards, outwards, the field doesn't change. So for example, one variation of psi would be such that as we let lambda go from zero to some positive values, the amplitudes of the field right here and some patch in here shoot up to large values. Or maybe here they go down to small values, or maybe both happens at once. There are infinitely many possibilities for what a variation could be. A variation is any one parameter parameterized deformation of what the field values are in here, as long as they are continuously, in fact, differentiably parameterized, and as long as this variation vanishes on the boundary and everywhere outside. So it's a parameterized change to what the values are of the function, and you can tell there are infinitely many ways of deforming a function, right? So I'm saying here a variation delta psi, right? So not the variation, a variation, there are infinitely many. You can cook up any way of deforming what the amplitudes are of this function in here. The only constraint is that it's got to be differentiably parameterized. It's got to be such that if lambda is equal to zero, then we haven't changed the field at all. And if lambda is varying, then the field is varying, but it's not varying on the boundary or outside. And then we define the variation of this field, I species at the point P, as the derivative of psi of lambda P. So this is this one parameter family. This is one parameter family of deformations of the field. And then the variation itself is the derivative with respect to lambda evaluated at lambda equal to zero of the field there. So in order to define a variation, delta psi, we come up with a one parameter family of deformations of the field. And then we differentiate that one parameter family of deformations at the point lambda equal to zero. And this is itself now a function of the positions, p. And it's a function that's, of course, zero on outside the b. On and outside the B. And so now the action principle that we had written in a very concise form like this, we can now write it in a precise form and explain what exactly it means. Namely, what that statement means is that if we differentiate the action with respect to the one parameter, set that equal to zero, for all possible variations, set that to equal to zero, that is what is meant by ds by d psi is equal to zero. Technically, that's uncountably many conditions here, because we have uncountably many possible deformations of the function. Okay, so let's evaluate that in practice. How does that look? So what we want is that 0 is ds by d lambda at lambda equal to 0 for all possible deformations, for all possible psi of lambda and p. So for all possible variations. So let's evaluate that. This then is the sum over all I, that's the particle species. And then here we have the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the species. And then here we have the variation of, by the chain rule, the variation of psi. Because we have dl by d psi, d psi by d lambda. But the d psi by d lambda, that's delta psi. Okay, so it's just chain rule, dl by d psi, d psi by d lambda, but d psi by d lambda we call delta psi. But then we also have that the Lagrangian doesn't depend only on the field only. It can also depend on the covariant derivative of the field. So we get another term with the chain rule where we have dl by d psi, but covariant derivative, and then d covariant derivative of psi with respect to lambda. So that's this here. So now we have the variation of the covariant derivative of the field. And then we could say, well, but how on earth are we going to evaluate that? What is that, the variation of the covariant derivative? Now, it turns out that this is the covariant derivative of the variation. So the variation of the covariant derivative, here's the semicolon, is equal to the covariant derivative of the variation. And why is that? Well, it's because we can go into the, we can look at this equation at any arbitrary point, P, where we choose a Riemann normal coordinate system, a geodesic coordinate system, where this variation is an ordinary derivative, and that is an ordinary derivative, because the Christoffel symbol vanishes. And then it's this is true at that point in that coordinate system. But because it's true in a Riemann normal coordinate system, we can then also infer that it's true in any coordinate system because it's a covariant equation. And that's a general principle that's very useful. If you want to prove that a covariant equation is true, then look at that covariant equation in a Riemann normal coordinate system at its origin, where the equation simplifies because the covariant derivatives become just ordinary derivatives. If it's true there, well, then it's true in general. Okay, so that means that the second term, remember we have two terms, one is differentiating L by psi and then d psi by d lambda. Here we have the L by d psi covariant derivative and then d covariant derivative by d lambda. So in this second term here, we have that we can flip, we can switch around the covariant derivative and the variation. And then we obtain that this second term takes the form of the L by the covariant derivative and then the covariant derivative of the variation of psi. Whew. Well, so now we have the covariant derivative of a variation. That's not so easy to deal with. So what we can do then is that we use, in effect, what is integration by parts, but with the covariant derivative instead of the ordinary derivative. And let's be very careful about this, okay? We can't just claim, oh, we just do integration by parts. No, it's a covariant derivative. We have to be damn careful with it. So here's how we do that. Let us look at this expression here. Let's call that a vector k superscript e. you see, all these indices, the contravariant and the covariant ones, are contracted with each other. We just have one extra index because of the covariant differentiation here. Let us look at that particular vector here and covariantly differentiate it with e and sum over e. Then what do we get? Two terms. By the Leibniz rule, we get two terms. We get the covariant derivative of this term, leaving that the same, plus, leaving that term the same, times the covariant derivative of that. Okay? So what do we get when we take this expression here and we take the term where we have the covariant derivative on this and that one is just carried forward? Well, that's just this term here, right? Where this term is just the same as that and that bracket is differentiated. So by writing down this term, we reproduce that. But we also get an unwanted term, which is the term where we differentiate this piece and leave that the same. That term is not here, so we have to subtract it, right? So in effect, what we did was an integration by parts, but not quite. It's just the first step. So we use the Leibniz rule here in order to write this expression as the difference between these two terms. Now, it turns out that this term here is a boundary term. Namely, let's give this whole thing a name. It's a contravariant vector k superscript e, and we have to covariantly differentiate it there. So what we have is that this integral here is really that integral. And I'll leave it to you as an exercise, even though I think we actually did it explicitly in one of the earlier lectures, to show that this expression is actually the divergence of the vector field K with respect to the volume form that's given by square root of g d4x. I think we had that in an earlier lecture. So that's just a little exercise that I suggest you do. Okay, so, but if this then is the is the divergence, and remember, you know, in Minkowski space, that would be what we would call the divergence of a vector field, right? It's simply the first component of the vector field differentiated in the first direction plus the second component differentiated in the second direction, and so on. It's just a covariant version of that, and with that measure here. So this is the divergence of the vector field. But then remember, we have Gauss's theorem. And according to Gauss's theorem, the divergence of a vector field can be obtained by taking the volume form and putting and taking the inner derivation of it in the direction of k, which is to say that the volume form is, remember, it's an n form. In space-time, that's a 4 form. And then the inner derivation means we just take that vector k and plug it into the first argument of omega. And that turns this 4 form into a 3 form. And by Gauss theorem, we are relating here the integral over a divergence over the full 4 dimensions, the bulk, to an integral over the boundary del b of the inner derivation of it, which is, this is a 3 form to be integrated over 3 dimensions. That's a 4 form to be integrated over 4 dimensions. So we're using Gauss's theorem here. You see, this is how it looks in differential geometry to do what normally we just do instinctively as integration by parts. Okay, but this thing doesn't contribute because we have that this vector field, k, this expression here, is proportional to the variation, and we want this variation to vanish on the boundary and outside. On the boundary of the region B and further out, we want this to, we defined it to vanish, and so therefore, there is no contribution from that, which means that the second term has only this contribution, not that one. So then let's collect the terms. We have that from the action principle, ds by d lambda is equal to, and then we have here the first term, which comes from the derivation of L with respect to psi, and then psi with respect to lambda, but d psi by d lambda is the variation. And then the second term has only this thing surviving with a minus sign from the integration by parts here, and that's that term. And now both of them are multiplied just with the variation of psi, multiplied with just d psi by d lambda at lambda equal to 0. And that has to be 0 by the classical action principle. This has to be 0 for all variations delta psi. So that means that since we can pull this out, we can factor this out, this means that the difference between those two terms has to vanish, because it has to be true that the integral over that for all of these is equal to 0. So therefore, we can deduce the Euler-Lagrange equations. So here we have the covariant version of the Euler-Lagrange equations. You remember that in special relativity, this would be dl by d psi minus dl by d space or time derivative of psi, and then the whole thing again differentiated. That's just a covariant version of it. Notice that here we have a covariant derivative, and there we have a covariant derivative. And at any point in the manifold, we can again choose a Riemann normal coordinate system or a geodesic coordinate system, and then these would be ordinary derivatives. And so what we have that at every point we can make the gammas go away, right? Okay, so these are the equations of motion then. Now let's do the simplest example where our species psi is just a scalar field psi, so no contravariant or covariant indices, and let's say it's real value, just to keep things as simple as possible. Such real valued scalar fields can describe, for example, so-called pi mesons or the inflaton particle. What would be the equation of motion for that? What would be the Lagrangian for a scalar field? Well, the way to do that is that we choose geodesic coordinates at a point where the Christoffel symbols vanish, and then we write down the Lagrangian for our scalar field as we know it from special relativity, and then we turn the ordinary derivatives into covariant derivatives, and the equation will therefore be covariantized for general relativity. So imagine these are not semicolons, but are just commas. If these are just commas, this would be the Lagrangian for a real scalar field in Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates. By just putting the semicolons on it, we now allow arbitrary coordinate systems and, in fact, the presence of gravity as well. And in general, this works for all kinds of fields. We just write down what the special relativistic action or Lagrangian is, and we replace the ordinary derivatives by covariant derivatives. That allows us two things. First of all, to generalize to arbitrary coordinates, not just Cartesian ones, but also to allow the presence of gravity, which is to say, to allow that the gamma may not, to allow that there may not be a coordinate system in which the gamma vanishes everywhere.
I have a question. Uh-huh. In Minkowski space, like you get these Lagrangians by computing the representations of the Poincaré group, but in a general spacetime, there is no such symmetry anymore. So how?
Yes, but locally you have that.
Locally.
Locally you have that, that's right. And so you basically go by the Lie algebra representation of it. But in this case, it's still trivial because just scalars. In fact, we will have to deal today with a rather non-trivial case where we deal with the Dirac equation, because there we have the gamma matrices, and the gamma matrices have anti-commutation relations that involve the Minkowski space metric, right? And then if we wanted to replace that by a generic metric, that would be a terrible mess, because at every point in space-time, we would have to choose a different set of gamma matrices. All right, so this is the Lagrangian for a real-valued scalar field in curved space-time. And then from that, I leave it to you as an exercise. If you plug that into here, you can calculate what the Klein-Gordon equation is, and the Klein-Gordon equation comes out to be this. So you take the second covariant derivative of the scalar field psi and contract that with the metric, get a scalar, and then minus m squared over h bar squared psi equal to zero. That's the massive Klein-Gordon field, Klein-Gordon equation. By the way, this semicolon here, right, that means we do two covariant differentiations. But the first covariant differentiation is an ordinary differentiation, right? And that's because it's a differentiation of a scalar. Right? If you differentiate the scalar, it's still the ordinary derivative, but then you get a vector and you differentiate that again, then you get the Christoffel symbol, and then you contract the whole thing. So that's one way of writing the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, let's look at the electromagnetic field. Let's assume for simplicity at the beginning that there are no charges and no currents. So that means we describe only electromagnetic waves, but not, for example, the field around a charge. So then let's define the electromagnetic four potential as a real number valued one form A. So you remember from earlier in the course that that's what it is. The vector potential in electromagnetism is actually a one form. It's a covariant vector field. And then from that covariant vector field, from that one form, we can, by exterior differentiation, calculate the field strength tensor, which is a two form. And if you remember from the earlier lectures, this two form is, being a two form, it's a twofold covariant, totally antisymmetric two tensor. And if you write it as a matrix, because it's anti-symmetric, it has zeros on the diagonal. But then in the off-diagonal, it has the electric and the magnetic fields. It has six independent of diagonal components, and they are the two components of the electric field and the two components of the magnetic field. And from that, we recognize that the electric and the magnetic fields are not vector-valued fields. They are components of a two-form. That's what they are differential geometrically. Then the Lagrangian for the electromagnetic field is minus 1 over 16 pi. We know that from special relativity of f mu, or FAB, FCD, and then contracted with the metric. And that's all we need to do in order to make it generally covariant. We just have to keep in mind that to lower and raise the indices so that they can be contracted, we should not use the special relativistic eta, but we should use the general relativistic G. So already, this is then the covariant theory. And then if we plug that into the other Lagrange equations, again, that's an exercise for you to do, then you find that the other Lagrange equation for this field is simply this one. Now, we also have this equation here. And I mean, the first equation here is if there were charges and currents, they would appear on the right-hand side. These are the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations, as we will later see again, inhomogeneous Maxwell equations. But then we also have the homogeneous Maxwell equations, which are those Maxwell equations that have on the right-hand side always a zero, no matter whether they are charges and currents. And they hold for a different reason. They don't hold because of an Euler Lagrange equation. They hold, the homogeneous Maxwell equations hold because F is an exact two-form, because it's the exterior derivative of that one-form. And so therefore, D of F is zero. Right? Because d of f is d squared of a, and d squared is always 0. So that's a non-trivial equation for f, namely df is equal to 0. And that equation is this one. So it's that equation. So when we look at the Maxwell equations, to keep in mind here is that half of them are Euler Lagrange equations. The other half is purely differential geometry. Just because A is a one-form, F is a two-form, that is exact, and therefore the homogeneous Maxwell equations hold. Now let's look at the introduction of charges. Now let's say, to keep things simpler, we will do the issue with the spinners in a moment, but let's not have too many issues happen all at once. So let's now couple electromagnetism to a scalar charged field. So imagine we have a charged scalar field. In principle, of course, electrons have a spin index, but we could also have a charged scalar field. Something like, for example, a pi plus or a pi minus meson, which consists of two quarks. So they can be described as a scalar, and they can be charged. See, they are bosons, and because they're made out of two quarks, which are fermions, and then if you arrange the spin right that they are opposite, you can have a spin zero component in there. So, so let's consider the coupling now of a scalar charged field to electromagnetism. Now we have two kinds of fields that interact with each other. We have electromagnetism interacting with the charge, and we have the charge having its own equation of motion, but also coupled to electromagnetism. So what we expect is a modified equation for electromagnetism that takes into account the presence of the charged field, but also the charged field is not just obeying a trivial Klein-Gordon equation, it's also modified, its equation of motion is modified because it's affected by electromagnetism. So we have truly the interaction of both of those fields. The charge field interacts with the electromagnetic field, and none of them is background. Both of them are dynamical, and they interact with each other. And the whole thing is now on the background of a curved space-time. So curvature is affecting all of this, but we are not giving curvature its own degree of freedom yet. We're just saying it's a background thing. Later, in principle, later what we will see is that no, the metric has its own dynamics, and so then all of this stuff is interacting with each other. But that makes it completely untractable then, because gravity is a highly nonlinear theory, and so we can't work by linear superposition of solutions, and it just becomes a huge mess. All right, but for now, this. So by the equivalence principle, we can again put together what the Lagrangian is. Namely, we just write down the Lagrangian of special relativity and covariantize it by introducing the metric tensor of general relativity and covariant instead of contravariant differentiations. So what we have is that the Lagrangian consists of the following terms. We have derivatives of psi, and that's in principle the kinetic term for the charges, right? It's like p squared over 2m in quantum mechanics. We have here the psi star differentiated psi differentiated. That's a quadratic term with derivatives, like the kinetic term for the scalar charges. And then here's the mass term for the scalar charges. So just this term and that together would be just the free Klein-Gordon theory of the charge. Remember, we had that up here. We have it here, you see? Here we have the mass term, psi squared, and here we have derivative, metric. The only difference down there is that the scalar field is also charged. The introduction of a charge means that you make the field complex. If the field is real valued, then it doesn't interact with relativity, with electromagnetism. And if you want to see why that is so, I wrote it up here in small print in black. Okay, so what we have is that this term together with that term gives us the free Klein-Gordon theory for a charged field, for a charged scalar field. And charged, we recognize that by having that it's a complex field. And we have then to take the complex conjugate times the field in order to get something that's real valued, because the Lagrangian has to be real valued, because the action has to be real valued. Okay, and then we turn this into covariant derivatives in the sense of electromagnetism by adding to this derivative term also minus or plus IE, the four vector field. That's just the usual minimal coupling of electromagnetism. If you haven't seen it, don't worry too much, but I mean, if you come from math, but those who come from physics should have seen this before, that this is how the coupling between how electromagnetism is introduced into the evolution of matter fields. Essentially, the A play the role of gammas for electromagnetism, because here we have a derivative, and then that's an affine connection that's added. But not in the sense of differential geometry, but in the sense of a gauge theory. Okay, so that's still the p squared over 2m term for the field psi. This is the derivatives squared over 2. There's no mass term here. That's the kinetic term for the charged field and how it couples to the electromagnetism. And here, this is the action of the free electromagnetic field. Now, that's the total action. I mean, it's a Lagrangian. If integrated over, we obtain the action. And it depends on two sorts of species, namely on the psi field and the A field. And of course, F depends on the A field. F is just the exterior derivative of the A field. So now we get two equations of motion. One, by using the action principle to vary with respect to psi and set that equal to zero, that gives us the equation of motion for psi. And we functionally differentiate also, according to the action principle with respect to A, set that equal to zero, and that gives us the equations of motion of electromagnetism. Now, let's start with the equations of motion for the Klein-Gordon field, for the psi field. If we now plug all of this with its interaction terms, you see terms that involve as psi as well as A, if we do that, then we obtain this, the equation of motion for the charged field. It's now the Klein-Gordon equation term, you know, that's just the Klein-Gordon term that we had above. And then all of this is the coupling between the matter fields, the between the charge field and the A field. So what this means is the psi field, the charge field, behaves according to the Klein-Gordon equation, except it is influenced by A as well. The presence of A is modulating what the psi will do. If we functionally differentiate with respect to psi instead of psi star, we get this equation complex conjugated, but that's the same equation. Now, let's take this Lagrangian and vary it with respect to A, and then we get the modification that electromagnetism experiences. Here we have the inhomogeneous Maxwell equation, this one here, but no longer just a zero here. Now we have all these terms arising, and what we see here is that, yeah, the electric and the magnetic fields behave as if free, except there's all of this to take into account, which means that the electrically charged field psi is now sourcing the electric and the magnetic fields. So what we have here is that on the background of a curved space-time, where the metric is held frozen, we didn't give it any dynamics, we assume it to be given and known, we need to solve these two equations together to find out how the charged field and the electromagnetic field interact with each other. It's just the same as it would be in Minkowski space, except that we have changes due to the curvature. What we are assuming implicitly in this is that there is not too much of the charge field around. There is not too much of the electromagnetism around, because if there was a lot of it, that would have to act on the curvature. So we're assuming that the curvature is dominant, and that's not much. That's just a few charges. It's a field that's not much, that doesn't have much charge in it, and the electromagnetic field doesn't have too much energy in its electric and magnetic field either, so that we don't have to look into the back reaction. But of course, in principle, the back reaction is there. Now, so far, we considered the charged field to be a scalar field. But we don't know fundamental scalars that are charged. The Higgs field is not charged electromagnetically. So the fundamental ones, I mean, we said we could take pi plus, pi minus, but they're not fundamental because they are made out of two quarks. So an electron, yeah, that would be charged, but it's a spinner field. So let's look at the Dirac equation now. How can we make that covariant? This is a huge topic. Several lectures could be dedicated to that. So let's do just the most important parts of this. In special relativity, we have this equation. That's the Dirac equation. Very beautiful, but special relativistic. You see, we have just the ordinary derivatives here. Now, you might think, okay, cool, I just make this a semicolon here and I'm done. But I'm not, because remember that in this Dirac equation, these gamma matrices are 4x4 matrices that act on this 4-spinner here. It has 4 components, this psi of x, the spinner field. And in reality, this m here is multiplied with an identity matrix that is 4x4. And these gamma matrices have to have a special property, namely their anti-commutator has to be twice eta mu nu being the metric. And there's a good reason for that. There's a reason for why the anti-commutator has to be the 2 eta mu nu. And that's because we want this thing to be covariant. But if, for example, we chose an arbitrary vector here, not a matrix-valued vector, but some arbitrary vector, well, then that would fix a coordinate system. But what vector should we choose there, right? So it has to be something covariant, and Dirac, being a genius, figured out how that works. Namely, he said, maybe we can choose those gammas, those gamma matrices, in a really clever way so that every component of psi obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. If that's true, then we know the whole thing is covariant because the Klein-Gordon equation is covariant. So he said, let's do that. Let's see if we can arrange the gammas to be matrices such that each component of psi obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. So what he did is he said, well, okay, let's take that equation here and multiply it from the left with the complex or the Hermitian conjugate, right? So we or the complex conjugate, we just take that matrix here and multiply it here again. That's still zero, right? If this alone is zero, then if I multiply from the left with whatever I want, it's still zero. So what he said is, let's take the Klein-Gordon equation and multiply from the left with the complex conjugate here. Right? So instead of I, it's minus I. That still has to be zero because that alone is already zero. Okay, so then let's work out what it is. We get minus I gamma mu minus times I gamma nu. That gives us a plus because minus I times I is plus one. And then we have the gamma mu, and the two derivatives. Okay. And then we get we get this I gamma nu d nu times m. That's this one. And then we get a term where this is multiplied with the m. So we get these two terms are this term and that term. And then we also have the m squared term over here. Okay, so we know that that is true. Here we have that the gamma mu is multiplied with the del mu, since those two commute. We can also write this as gamma mu, doesn't really matter because those two commute. But that also means we can write this as the anti-symmetric sum, as the symmetric sum. We can write this part in this way. We can write this as, where is it here? We can write it as 1 half gamma mu plus gamma mu times that. And we drop these terms because they drop out, right? So you have this one times that, and this time it's the same. Okay, so what we have is that right, okay. So we have that if the Dirac equation holds, then that equation holds. And now, all Dirac had to do was to say, well, if I choose this expression to be the metric, then this is just the, this just gives me the Klein-Gordon equation here. That's just give me the D'Alembertian, right? So by choosing this combination to be twice the metric, or one half of this to be equal to the metric, then I just get the contraction here with the eta mu nu, and therefore that's the Klein-Gordon equation for each of the components. Right? So if this is just the eta mu nu, well, times the identity matrix, right? So this is 4 by 4 matrix, and the whole thing is a 4 by 4 identity matrix times the eta mu nu, then we have that every component of the Dirac spinner obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, therefore the whole thing is covariant. Dirac was motivated by the following consideration. He started with the Schrödinger equation, and he said, well, the Schrödinger equation is not covariant, and how can we make it covariant? So if we have I h bar dt psi equal to Laplacian over 2m psi plus m psi, then how can we make this covariant? The trouble is that we have one time derivative here, and here we have two space derivatives. How could this ever be covariant? How could it be covariantized? And Klein and Gordon said, how about we do it like this, right? So Klein and Gordon said, well, let's lift the time derivative to a second time derivative, and then we can covariantize it, and they arrived at the Klein-Gordon equation. But there was a big problem with this, which was that the Klein-Gordon equation in first quantization doesn't work. And the reason is that essentially the Hamiltonian cannot be bounded from below. The energy spectrum cannot be bounded from below. And this means that it's an unstable theory. It would just create particles without end, and you can't, I mean, it's just not a stable theory in first quantization. And the solution to this problem, Dirac didn't know yet. The solution to this problem with the Kangorden equation is that you have to treat it quantum field theoretically. In quantum field theory, the Hamiltonian will be bounded from below, but and you have to introduce antiparticles and all of that. That's stuff that Dirac himself later fixed, but he didn't know that at the time. So Klein and Gordon said, roughly speaking, let's put the second derivative there, then we have a second derivative here and a second derivative there. We can covariantize that. Dirac said, well, what if we turn that into a first derivative, right? And that's how he came up with the idea of writing down that equation, where we have not only a first time derivative, but also a first space derivative. But then, how can this ever work? How can you covariantize it? Because you have now a four vector that you have to contract with another four vector. But if you choose an ordinary four vector, then you're breaking the symmetry. Because in some coordinate system, that four vector will have lots of zeros and a one. But that's singling out that coordinate system. Right? So it breaks covariance to choose a particular vector field. That's how he came up with all of this. So Dirac actually solved both problems here by figuring out that the Klein-Gordon approach can be fixed by taking into account antiparticles and by coming up with the Dirac equation. So now, here's the problem. The Dirac equation is fine. In special relativity, we can turn this into covariant derivatives, but the gammas obey this anti-commutation relation. We have to do something about this. Now, we don't want to put the G menu here, because then at every point in the space-time, we would have to choose different gamma matrices that obey that, and that's a mess. In any case, try to go through this and see if it's still true. See, you have even if you put that here with a metric, because you would have that the metric would be space and time dependent, and this could catch in here, and it's a mess. You can't just make this a G mu nu and think that this will work. No, there's another way to do that. Namely, we choose an orthonormal tetrad. Remember, we can always choose our bases in the vectors in the tangent space and the cotangent space, whichever way we want. Independently of the coordinate system, we can still choose whatever basis we want in the tangent space, in the cotangent space. So let us choose some orthonormal tetrad theta I, which are they are basis vectors in the cotangent space. And we can choose them in such a way that at every point of the manifold, simultaneously, the basis is such that the metric is diagonalized, and it's just the eta mu nu. We know that we can do it at every point, even with the old choice of the dx, I mean, the old basis that comes with the coordinate system. We can do it at a point, but we simply apply that choice now for every point using a tetrad, and so we can achieve that this is the metric everywhere, at the cost of having to keep track of what the basis vectors are now. So now, one set of matrices gamma mu will work. We can use Dirac's Dirac matrices. And then that motivates that we generalize the Dirac equation to this equation, I gamma mu, and then the covariant derivative in the direction of E mu. So that's just the covariant derivative, covariantization of that derivative, minus m psi equal to 0. And that is true. That's how it works in principle. But what does that mean actually? Because here we are covariantly differentiating a spinner. We have not seen that before. So how do we do that? How do we calculate the covariant derivative of a spinner field? Now, for that, let's keep in mind that the covariant derivative of a vector field, not a spinner field, but of a vector field, gives us the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that the vector undergoes under an infinitesimal parallel transport. Right? Because the Christoffel symbols describe what happens under infinitesimal parallel transport. So the idea then is that the covariant derivative of a spinner should also give us the infinitesimal rotation of the spinner in the spinner space according to the same infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. So since we already know how to parallel transport vectors and tensors, now we need to figure out how to parallel transport spinners, at least infinitesimally, because that describes how a spinner then is differentiated, covariantly differentiated. Let's remember briefly how this works with vectors. Imagine we have a vector E, index rho, that's a tangent vector, let's say a basis tangent vector E rho. Then under parallel transport, it goes into E rho plus the covariant derivative of E rho in the direction of E mu. So we are parallel transporting in the direction of E mu. And what is it? Well, we get that the change of direction of our vector is given by this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation here, right? That's the connection one form. Here we plug into this one form the direction in which we parallel transport. In terms of Christoffel symbol, we are contracting with one of the lower indices. So we take the connection one form, we feed it in the vector of in the direction of the parallel transport that we want to do. We get this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation out, and that acts on our vector, and we get the change of direction here. So we get that this is an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, a full Lorentz transformation. Let's write it as a capital lambda, and then the capital lambda maps a tangent vector into a tangent vector by this Lorentz transformation, by this matrix, and the infinitesimal version of that is that the Lorentz transformation is the identity plus, and this is a Kronecker delta because we have one upper, one lower index. Would be a metric if it was two lower indices. So it's Lorentz transformation is equal to identity matrix plus, and then this matrix here, that's the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, and infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, if you take both indices lower, then this is an anti-symmetric tensor. Maybe you remember that you get always this anti-symmetry when you go from a finite rotation to an infinitesimal rotation. Okay, so we have the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation for infinitesimal parallel transport. And now the strategy is this. We define the parallel transport of a spinner to be according to the same infinitesimal Lorentz transformation as the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that's applied to any vector or tensor as well. We just have to keep track of how Lorentz transformations act on spinners. Now, from special relativity, let us recall how that works. Let's say the SI are basis vectors in the spinner space. So the spinner space is four-dimensional, so it's four basis vectors. Let's call an orthonormal basis of these of the spinner space S index I running from 1 to 4. Which means that our spinner field, psi, can be written as coefficient functions, psi superscript ix, and then s index I. These are spinner indices. They are not covariant or contravariant. These are spinners is a different thing. And how do they transform under local Lorentz transformations? So under Lorentz transformations in special relativity. Because from that, we will then be able to infer what is the covariant derivative of a spinner basis vector. Because once we know how a Lorentz transformation acts on spinners, we know how the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation acts on the spinner. That is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation that comes with the parallel transport. All right, so from special relativity, we know that under infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, namely these guys, remember that's the same as here again, they transform as a tangent vector goes into tangent vector plus that. I don't know why I wrote that again. I already wrote it over here. But the Dirac spinners transform, and I'll have to... I can't explain all of it. I have to hope that you've seen this before, how Dirac spinners act under or are being acted upon by a Lorentz transformation. So the spinner goes into itself minus a quarter, and then this is the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation map. And these, the commutator of the gamma matrices is the generator of rotations in spinner space. So the Lorentz group has an infinitesimal version, which is the Lorentz Lie algebra, and its generators are these commutators of the gamma matrices. And they act in this way. Here I gave you a summary in small print of why this comes about. For the moment, what's important is that from special relativity we know that if you have a spinner and you act with it, you act on it with an infinitesimal Lorentz transformation, then the actual action on the spinner space is using these gamma matrices, the commutator of gamma matrices.
Is there a missing factor of 1/2 here?
Am I missing a factor of 1/2?
Where? Second term.
Where, here?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't tell by heart. I'd have to look it up. If you can confirm that a factor of 1/2 is missing, let me know and I'll fix it in the notes.
Probably a convergence.
Okay. So now we want to apply that to GR. So what do we have? We have that if a vector E mu is infinitesimally parallel transported in the direction of EA, then it obtains an infinitesimal Lorentz rotation, namely this one. And for a vector, it's this infinitesimal Lorentz transformation directly that acts on this vector, on this contravariant vector. And from that, we can read off that, as we knew from before, that the covariant derivative of a vector in the direction of another vector is given directly by this connection one form. But now, when a spinner is infinitesimally transported in the same direction, EA, then the spinner will be subject to the same infinitesimal Lorentz transformation omega, which is the value of the connection one form, but the way that it acts now is in on spinners is different, namely the spinner goes into the spinner minus this expression here, modulo perhaps a factor of 1/2, but I still think that this is right. We just have to make sure that we work in a frame in which the gamma matrices are always the same. And since this is the change of the of a spinner under infinitesimal Lorentz transformations, we can again read off, just like we read off from here, what the covariant derivative is of a tangent vector in the direction of a tangent vector. Here we can read off from that what the covariant derivative of a spinner is in the direction of a tangent vector, namely, it's this. What we see is that the covariant derivative of the basis vectors Si in the direction of a tangent vector Ea is this. So we have this matrix here acting on these spinners. And this is a basis vector in the space of spinners. A general spinner field is having a coordinate function, has coordinate functions in front of these basis vectors. So a general spinner field has coordinate functions psi I of x times these basis vectors. And then, as usual, we can use the Leibniz rule to find out what the covariant derivative of a full Dirac field is. So not just the covariant derivative of a basis vector of spinners, but on a generic one. So the covariant derivative of a spinner field in the direction of EA, the covariant derivative in the direction of EA of coordinate function times basis vector in the spinner space, and we get a covariant derivative on the coefficient functions, and that's simple, right? Because that's just derivatives, because these coefficient functions are just scalar functions. The spinner nature is only in the basis vectors as I, plus undifferentiated here, and then here we get the covariant derivative of the basis vector in the direction of EA, but that's what we just calculated here. So overall, we get that the covariant derivative of a spin-off field is given by the derivative of the spin-off field's components, ordinary derivatives there, and then this expression here, which involves non-trivial matrices in the 4x4 matrices in the space of spinners. So therefore, the general relativistic Dirac equation looks as simple as this. But in practice, this covariant derivative acting on the psi actually plays out to be this. And so it has this non-trivial business here in addition.
Is there any way to determine the W matrix from, for example, like connections or the matrix?
The omega?
The omega matrix.
Yeah, the omega is the gamma. Remember that the omega is the... You see, it's a connection one form, which means, you know, it has two indices, an upper and a lower index, and these are the indices of the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation. But one index is suppressed because it's a form with respect to that one. So it really has two lower indices and one upper index. So it's a Christoffel symbol. And in this case, it's a Christoffel symbol in a frame in which the metric always takes the form of the eta minu.
So that means, like, in special relativity, the infinitesimal Lorentz transformation is replaced by the connection one form in general relativity, right?
Well, yes, in special relativity, we don't have that, except if we choose non-trivial coordinate systems. For example, if you choose some sort of spherical coordinate system or something like that, then that would come up again. The Dirac equation is a huge mess. Even in flat space, if you choose non-Cartesian coordinates. Yeah, so explicitly then, the Dirac equation looks like this, and the beauty is gone, isn't it? this is really nice. That's not so pretty anymore. Okay, now, there is a pretty version too, though. In the last 2 or 3 minutes, let me explain that. So this is the hard way, this is the pedestrian way to do it, but it's showing all the machinery in it. But more elegantly, you can also do the following. Remember, the Dirac operator squared is just a Klein-Gordon operator, right? It's just a D'Alembertian. We showed that if you take the Dirac operator squared, you basically get that, right? Now, let's look at this quantity here, d plus del, and define that. And then, what is this squared? Well, that's going to be d squared, which goes away, plus del squared, which goes away, plus d del plus del d, right? Do you recognize what that is? Yeah, that's the Laplacian, right? So that's that. Now, there's a whole theory behind this by which you can see the Dirac operator as being that. And then you can see that the spinner space is not just something completely new externally that we introduced, but it's actually contained in your tensor space. Now, you see, we have the Grassmann algebra of differential forms, where we have zero forms, one form, two forms, three forms. But it turns out you can view, the Grassmann algebra is just the algebra of tensors specialized to the antisymmetric ones. And we gave it a new multiplication, the wedge product. But there's yet another multiplication you can do on that same space. And that multiplication, this new multiplication, gives us then not the Grassmann algebra, but the so-called Clifford algebra. And it turns out that the spinners are elements of that Clifford algebra. So they are not really one forms, two forms, or something like that. Complicated linear combinations of them. And to really keep track of the bookkeeping of this, you need to review the Grassmann algebra as actually having another multiplication, essentially the multiplication for these gamma matrices, and then you can see the Dirac operator also as acting on your tensors. So basically, there's a trade-off. We can either do it the hard way we did here, or we can do it the elegant way over there. But if we do it the elegant way, then we have to introduce a whole new concept of Clifford algebras and their derivations and all of that. I invite you to do that, but I think it would take us too far to do this, because at some point we want to do general relativity. Right? But I just want to give you the lead to see in which direction you may want to read further. Okay, so that's it for today.